Next Monday, hearings on the legality of the barrier to separate Israelis from Palestinians begin at the International Court of Justice in The Hague. We are not going to talk today about whether or not the security barrier should stand, rather the mechanics of how this issue came before the World Court. And we'll preview the arguments on each side and the precedent for how the U.S. and other nations have responded to The Hague's decisions. Joining us now to walk us through the legal process is Ruth Wedgwood, a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and an international law professor with Johns Hopkins University. She's with us on the phone from outside of Washington, D.C., and good to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Neil.
How did the issue of the security barrier end up at the World Court in The Hague?
Well, it was kind of a rushed proceeding. In early December, the General Assembly of the UN in New York voted a motion to seek a so-called advisory opinion, which is one of three ways of getting to the International Court of Justice. And it went through very quickly. The court set unprecedentedly rapid schedule for hearing it, demanding that any state filings be completed by the end of January, and then put it down for this hearing in February 23rd. And they're going to broadcast it on the web as well.
So there's it's certainly not behind closed doors. Can you outline for us what you would expect the likely arguments from each side are going to be?
Well, I think the arguments will treat initially the question of jurisdiction, but may well meld the merits into the same argument.
And by jurisdiction, whether this should be before the World Court at all?
Whether it should be, because there are some contentious issues on using this kind of General Assembly referral power. This is the same mechanism that they used last time to get the issue before the court of whether nuclear weapons were per se illegal. And I know many judges on the court regretted that they had ever had to face that case because it left them in a very difficult posture back then in 96. But I think what the Palestinians will argue is that it's within the power of the General Assembly to refer any legal question that the Assembly thinks it needs to discharge its own duties, and the EGA is nothing if not interested in the fence. I think then on the merits, the Palestinians will say that the fence interferes with their freedom of movement, that it cuts off many of the people on the West Bank from their farms and from medical services and from their families, and forces them to go through checkpoints, which inevitably involve some delay. They will describe it, I think, as an intention, secret intention by Sharon to annex the territory. I think they'll urge it as urgent because the wall is still under construction. And I think the unspoken hope on the part of some of the Palestinian diplomats who've been involved in this, they've spoken it actually in the hallways, is that the court will opine once and for all on who owns the West Bank. I think in a funny way they're hoping to get a kind of backdoor territorial boundary demarcation, something that's never happened before, because the boundaries between the West Bank and Israel proper have never been settled since the 1948 war between the Arab states that didn't accept Israel's founding.
And this security barrier is either rising or is planned to be placed in parts of territory that do not accord, that go into West Bank areas that are not along the line of the 1967 frontiers, which is, I guess, the issue.
Well, the boundary that's in question is the so-called armistice line of 1949.
Mm-hmm.
In 67, Israel had, of course, taken control of the West Bank.
Yes.
And went beyond it. And
I meant before 67.
Yeah, and ended the settlements.
Yes.
But I think the easiest handle for the Palestinians is to say, well, we don't care what Israel does on a real boundary, but this is beyond the so-called green line, and therefore it's into what is presumptively our territory and what many organs of the UN say is our territory.
We're speaking with Ruth Wedgwood of the Council on Foreign Relations. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. So how is Israel likely to respond to this line of argument?
Well, I think Israel will first say challenge the jurisdiction on a number of different grounds, and in some regards will be joined by the U.S. in this. Israel will say that this is a very dangerous use of General Assembly political power to skirt around the consent-based a jurisdiction that the court should use to demarcate boundaries, that Israel has never agreed to hear every case before the ICJ, and nor does the U.S., and that this is sort of a short tail kind of jurisdiction. Secondly, that the vote in the GA was so divided, it was 90 countries in favor, but 74 abstaining and 8 against, that it doesn't fulfill the two-thirds requirement for a General Assembly recommendation on an important question. And third, that on jurisdictional questions, that the Security Council has this issue in hand, and that the GA is just forbidden under Article 12 of the Charter from poaching on Security Council questions. And on the merits, if I could just...
Go ahead, yep.
Israel will say it's self-defense, that it, of course it does cause hardship to Palestinians, but the issue is whether that's a proportionate hardship given the danger that Israel faces from the suicide bombings, that in fact the fence would let them avoid some of the harsher responses to suicide bombings, such as military operations and settlements in the Palestinian neighborhoods. Secondly, they'll say that the boundaries are unsettled, and that even if you assume that all of the West Bank is occupied territory, that under the fourth, they have to be careful how they make this argument because they don't concede that this treaty applies, but that even under the fourth Geneva Convention on occupied territories, a state can take proportionate measures for its own self-defense. I think what Israel really is concerned about is that this is maybe a kind of bum's rush as a prelude to sanctions, that if Sharon were to succeed in withdrawing from Gaza and sort of hiding then behind the fence on the West Bank, that the easiest response for pro-Palestinian countries is that to try to squeeze Israel economically by trying to have sanctions in the pariah status. And the concern that I think the U.S. will certainly share is that this may get the new opening in the peace process way off track, that there's a hope, even in the Secretariat at the U.N. and Kofi Annan's office, to build on the Gaza withdrawal. And instead, if you have a very histrionic proceeding in The Hague, that this will create a very bad atmosphere and rule out lots of the options and flexibility you might want to have on territory.
Yet you talk about those implications if no matter what it decides, International Court of Justice, the World Court's rulings are not binding.
Well, they're not binding, but for the court's sake and for the UN's sake and for the party's sake, you want to have a sense of legitimacy in what the court does. And when the court says what it thinks the law is, that carries some weight. It's the attempt, I think, to put a legal red ribbon on what has heretofore been a set of political statements. And the court has to be careful of its own prestige and its own capital. It can't have too many rulings that seem politicized without doing itself very long-term grave injury.
We just have a few seconds left, but how long is the procedure likely to take? How long are the arguments likely to last?
The oral arguments may last for several days, and how long the court then takes to write an opinion, it could be months. But the quick step march they've taken to put the case before them without really an adequate time, in my own view, to brief the questions, may be a harbinger that they're going to give a quick slam dunk answer.
And we say the World Court. How many judges from what countries?
15 judges. Usually the permanent five Security Council members get a judge, so China, U.S., Russia, France, Britain, Germany, Japan. One thing that Israel does not get in this proceeding, if it were a consent-based case, you'd have an Israeli ad hoc judge added to the bench. Here there is none. There is a judge from Egypt who's a regular judge.
Ruth Wedgwood, thanks very much.
Thank you.
I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.